back.
Welcome to the Prophecy Chronicles with your host, Paul Richard Price.
And hello and good evening to all my listeners in New Orleans, listening to the show at WPRN in New Orleans, as well as all of you worldwide. Thank you for listening to the show tonight. And this is Paul Richard Price, and this is the Prophecy Chronicles show. My guest tonight for the show is none other than Stephen Bassett. He's the extraterrestrial lobbyist and paranormal researcher and activist who's in charge of the Paradigm Research Group out of Bethesda, Maryland. Now, if you would, Stephen, could you tell our listeners a little bit about you, like if they didn't already know anyway?
Well, we should clarify one thing. I am not an extraterrestrial lobbyist. I am, in fact, an advocate for resolving the UFOET issue, which pretty sure involves extraterrestrials, and have been doing that for 13 years. Started with Paradigm Research Group is the principal vehicle in which I registered as a lobbyist with the Congress, and I did that in 1996. And then, since then, have done pretty much devoted the entire 13 years to pursuing the political resolution of this issue by whatever means possible, which includes, first of all, networking around the world with lots of other organizations and activists, and getting to know an awful lot of people, as well as building a very substantial media database. I've sent out hundreds of thousands of press releases over this 13 years. And then also concrete stuff like form the Political Action Committee, XPAC. It's the only PAC still devoted to this issue exclusively. Ran for Congress in 2002 on the ballot and discussed these issues with the Democratic and Republican candidate in debates, which was a kind of a show the flag kind of thing. Started the X Conference in 2004. Now we've had five of those, with 80 speakers, who some have spoken multiple times, a broad range of individuals, held that in the Washington area, launched the Exopolitics World Network in early 2008, and then followed that with the Exopolitics United States Network, created group pages for those, for the Exopolitics World Network has a group page, and eventually Paradigm Research Group will have one on Facebook, and have spoken, quite extensively, done nearly 1,000 interviews. So it's public education, it's advocacy, it's persuasion, it's engaging the media, lobbying the media as much, really, and to what extent possible, trying to engage the politicians, who are very, very difficult to deal with on this issue, even though the majority of them, I think, do know, one way or another, that the ET issue is real. So that sums up my last 13 years in a few words.
Well, and I was just reading your biography again, and it says that you were a trained physicist.
Degree in physics. I never actually practiced. I was never a physicist. I just got the degree in physics. I did not follow it up. But I was science-based. I'm science-based, very left brain, good in math and science, and so that's kind of where that's where I was when I left school in 1970.
Well, what brought a guy who's really left-brained and has a degree in physics into the forum of extraterrestrial or exopolitics?
I think a good analogy would be the guy who has a girl that he dated in high school, and they got along pretty well and what have you, and but then he went off to college or something and lost track, and then over the years maybe might have been a phone call, maybe an email, but not much. And 25 years goes by, and the guy eventually, he's divorced, he doesn't have a relationship, and he suddenly decides, you know, that girl in high school, that's really the one woman that I really kind of got along with. And he calls her up, and they meet, and they end up getting married, whatever, and they live happily ever after. It's kind of like that. I loved science fiction as a kid. I was good in math and science. And throughout my whole life, I always paid attention to the UFO issue. Whenever something happened in the news, I'd note that. I'd pay instant attention to it. But I never got involved in it. I did not belong to any groups, join organizations, do research, none of that. But if it was on the news, if it was an article, I read it. And it just tracked that way for nearly 25 years. Well, actually going back to high school. And so in 1995, at the age of 49, when I decided I really wanted to do something with my life that that meant something to me, that could be positive, that could make a difference, that kind of thing, which a lot of people, they reach a crisis. They frequently that point comes in their life. They've been doing things that really didn't mean much to them, but they don't pay the bills, whatever. And one day they realize, we're not going to live forever. When I did that, the UFO issue was right in front and center. It was just right there. And it was sort of saying, this is the thing you probably should have gotten into a long time ago, but you didn't. You need to look at it real hard. And so I guess you might say I called that high school sweetheart and looked into the UFO issue, realized how big it had gotten, how significant it had become, where it was, and realized this may be the most important issue of all time, and it's coming due. It's right. It's about ready to fall off the tree, in a sense. And so I made the decision, plunge in full bore in January of 1996, basically a lifetime commitment. In other words, this is it. This is what I'm going to do. No ambiguities, no doubts. And so that's how it happened. I had never had a sighting, still haven't had one. I've had no contact or extraordinary experiences of my own, though I have met scores of people who have and talked to them and been very impressed by their stories. But it was a kind of a life decision, and then once I got into it, Richard, I realized very quickly that I made the right decision. So each year that went by, I realized this is the thing to do. Didn't mean it was easy, but it was clearly the right call.
Well, let me ask you this real quickly, though. I mean, for a guy who, did many other things before you got into exopolitics, financially, for most ufologists, making money off of UFOs, if you're not a writer and all, is next to nada.
Right.
And how do you actually support yourself? Do you get funds from other people? Do ETs come down and give you a little extra spending cash here and there,
I wish they would. You know, there's never been a contactee that's ever reported being in a craft or in the presence of ETs when they had a credit card or money or a wallet or anything. I mean, they don't need it anymore, which is hardly surprising. I mean, I doubt in 1,000 years from now, assuming we're still around, we will have money. It's one of those things you move through, you transition past. You're right. First and foremost, one of the principal barriers to getting into this field is other obligations and aspects of your life. So as it happened, the way my life it had played out made it very possible for me to do this. A lot of people can't. There are a lot of people out there that would love to have done what I've done, perhaps. But they had a spouse. They had children. They had mortgages and bills. They had a career already. They had friends, people who depended on them in other ways. And the idea of walking away from that and plunging into the UFO ET issue later in their life is simply, probably appropriately, completely irresponsible. So I had none of those things. No kids, no wife, no cat, no dog, no house plants, nada. And no financial responsibilities either in that sense, meaning I didn't have obligations in that regard. I didn't have any money, but I didn't have obligations to have to be served. And so I was free to do it. And I had family in the Washington area so that I was able to live rent-free and go for it. Then I got a bit of an inheritance that kept me going for a couple of years. But that ran out, of course. And then eventually I had, done enough work that I was able to attract some support. So now I'm able to function on a very basic level based on the amount of support that comes in from various individuals. And recently that has dramatically been curtailed because of the economic chaos that was thrust upon us in late October of last year. So it's not easy. This is incredibly underfunded, given the importance of the issue, whether it's the activism or the research, to be honest with you. So you learn to do a lot, with a little. You get to be very frugal. You buy your clothes at Walmart, thrift shops or garage sales, and you don't take vacations and you don't splurge. So it's something you do when you truly believe in what you're doing. This is not uncommon for activists and advocacy work. Others have had some success or a few spectacular successes who have been involved in this issue and make a good deal of money that they've been able to live very well and do other things, but it's extremely unusual. And that's a direct result of the truth embargo. Remember, the government set out to embargo this issue and everybody in it, to ghettoize this issue and everybody in it, and embargo the acknowledgement of this issue from the people in a formal policy going well back into the late 40s and early 50s. And that helped to ensure that it wouldn't be taught, it wouldn't be covered appropriately by the press, it wouldn't be funded by philanthropists and granting institutions. It would be isolated, contained. And so that was the game that was being played. And so if you wanted to get in the game, you had to play by those rules until this embargo is over. And then I think things will change dramatically for everybody in the field. But for now, it is a tough sled. Anybody that wants to get in this needs to know that. This is extremely hard.
Well, one thing I've noticed, you know, like with the work that I do and doing my shows and all, is that I try to get out there and try to get the truth out to people and then let them make up their own minds. And the one thing I see about the ET situation is, you know, I'm kind of a agnostic on it when it comes to the belief. I'm not against the belief of extraterrestrials. I'm not for. I have an open mind. I want to see where the data leads me. And I've noticed for years you've done that. Now, you got into the work after Stephen Greer and others were doing the Disclosure Project. What was the primary reason for you getting into this type of activist work?
All right, to be clear, this Disclosure Project didn't start until after I got in. But CSETI, certainly, Stephen Greer, CSETI, and Starlight Project was well underway. He entered the field full bore in 1990. I entered it 6 years later. Well, I didn't know exactly how I was going to approach this issue. But I knew that I needed to go through a very good door. The start would be critical. But since I was willing to work for free, to do whatever, and not ask for income, that expanded the options. And so I was able to persuade the Program for Extraordinary Experience Research in Cambridge, Massachusetts, that was founded by John Mack under the Center for Psychology and Social Change, to come and work there as a volunteer full-time on development stuff. So it was an exciting thing, and it was an honor to be around Mac at all and to be part of something he'd created. And I was there for 4 months, but it was clear after a couple months that this wasn't the fit for me. It wasn't what I was had a temperament for and where I could make a difference. But again, as I told you, once I got into this work, everything seemed to point in the right direction after that, you know? It's like when I entered this field for the first time in my life, I was running with the wind behind me. Whereas my entire life, prior to that, the wind was in my face. So I was sitting in Cambridge in the office up there when it just came to me. I was just sitting there and it came to me what I needed to do. Because of I knew Washington pretty well. I'd been in and out of it for years. Off and on, I knew I could live there. I was very much an activist at heart, though I hadn't really practiced much activism. It just occurred to me that somebody needed to get out in front of the political resolution of the issue. Someone needed to engage the politics of all this in every way possible. It wasn't happening. I was certain there had never been a lobbyist. I was certain there had never been a PAC. And so I packed up and headed to Washington right away and registered lobbyists to get underway, knowing that it would attract media attention and get things going, which it did. So, I identified a niche that had not been dealt with and one that fit my temperament and just plunged into it. So I was lucky in that sense that it came to me, but it did. And that's why no one was doing what this kind of work. No one was raising the issue in this way in a very open and formal way. At least no one that I was aware of. So it was a good decision, and I'm pleased that I made it. But that's why I chose the political thing. It was the right fit for me, and it was not being served.
Well, one thing I want to bring up to everybody is that when you get into activist work, you sacrifice a whole lot, you know, inside yourself as well as personal, interpersonal relationships and all. And I've seen that, you know, you've done that as well. I guess you've given up a lot in order to bring this cause to the forefront. And how has that affected you personally as well as even with friendships and all? Do people think that you're the crazy UFO guy?
No. They never did. When I got in the field in 96, things had moved far along. And there was less and less and less of that. The truth embargo was in place, and the ridicule would pop up at any time. But stuff directly at you, no. But I also, pretty mainstream left-brain guy, what I was doing was hardly shocking, right? I mean, it's one thing to say, look, I'm being picked up every couple of weeks by aliens, and they're taking me to other star systems, and they're bringing me back. I mean, and that very well could be happening, but it's one thing to be in that genre. It's another thing to be trying to raise the political resolution of the issue and address the government's past actions and talk about the truth embargo, form a political action committee. So I just wasn't an easy target for that kind of stuff, and it rarely has happened. And as far as being an activist, yeah, I've studied the lives of activists. It is not an easy path. It has its rewards, but it's a tough path to take. But again, I had almost nothing. I mean, I really had no assets and no family, so I had nothing to give up really by entering the field, which made it possible for me to do it. This is also true in the research. A lot of the people in the research are people that really had nothing to lose and they had nothing to give up, and they just went into it. Others, though, it's not the case. They've had to sacrifice a great deal just to enter the field. But once you go that route, what you give up is the future prospects of things, you know, down the line. You figure out pretty early you're never going to really have any money. If you're not married, you're not going to get married. These things are not going to happen because they're not compatible with the activist road, the path. If you can resign yourself to that, it's helpful. And that's, is it a sacrifice? I don't know. I mean, I can moan and complain as well as anybody, and I often do, but to call it a sacrifice is probably not mature. It's not appropriate. You make a decision to do something because you want to do it, and if it excites you and it puts you passion to complain that, oh well, you've sacrificed maybe having your own home or a newer car or more ability to, you know, that's kind of immature. Child. So I made the decision. My biggest problem is this. The funding issue is not about, gee, I'd have a nicer car or something. No, I don't really need that. Don't want it. I'm a less is more kind of guy now. I have been for a long time. What's frustrating is that the lack of funding makes it so much more difficult to advocate. There's so much more that could be done if the issue could get some decent funding from some people that saw the value and the wisdom of ending this truth embargo now rather than later and starting to get the government back in the truth business and possibly bring into the world some new physics that's been sequestered in the secret world for decades now. It would open up a lot of doors. It would create possibilities. So it's a little frustrating not having those funds. But they'll come when they come. I mean, you know, the job of the activist is to convince people that the work is worthy, and if people are not providing that money, ultimately you have not succeeded in convincing them of that, and so it's your responsibility. The fact the government's making it hard, yeah, okay. It would be nicer if the government had not been directly intervening in this process for six decades, But you knew that going in, right? That was the game that's being played. That's the hand you're playing. So it's silly to then, you know, get too angry about that because you knew that. But I know the funding is coming. It's the signs are there. There are countless numbers of individuals out there that could turn this issue around, dramatically change things with a single check, and I sense that they are closer and closer to writing those checks as we get nearer and nearer to disclosure, and the window of opportunity grows wider. So I'm optimistic, and I'm feeling pretty good these days. You caught me in a good mood. Now, there have been some times that I've done some interviews when I was really down about this, and it came across, but I'm feeling pretty positive right now, Paul, to be frank with you.
Well, great, and I'm glad to hear that. And let me also ask you here, what have you seen lately that, you know, has given you this positive outlook?
Oh, lots. Lots and lots. Look, in the U.S. right now, the whole political arena is kind of turned into a giant Jerry Springer show. But in terms of the FOET issue, oh Lord, one of the most important the series of events that have taken place that are notable more to, say, someone like myself than maybe just the average person in the street, but very notable, and that is that country after country has been releasing their UFO files, the majority of which have been previously classified. The first country to really start that ball rolling was France. They issued the Cometa study report in 2000, which was a study shepherded by a group that, while they weren't formally government, they were all previous members of military or national security or the police or whatever. I mean, these were high-level individuals. So it was basically a non-governmental study that was a message to the United States. And that report said that the ET, the extraterrestrial hypothesis, was the only logical explanation for this, and discussed how the United States government had decided to withhold the issue and keep it secret. Then a few years later, they started releasing documents, classified files, to the Internet, which were immediately seized on by the public. I mean, literally, the website shut down almost overnight. Then the United Kingdom started releasing documents. Mexico formally announced it was going to cooperate with UFO researchers down there, turned over some interesting evidence regarding an event. Might not have been a UFO event, doesn't matter. It was the act of doing it. Then Brazil did that, the Brazilian Air Force. Then the UK continued to release documents in a time-release fashion. And Canada started releasing documents in 2006, 3 years now. They've been releasing UFO files to the Internet. Then Sweden jumped in. Denmark jumped in. And so what's happening is the disclosure train has been slowly leaving the station, and one country after another is jumping on the train. And then a significant note, just about 10 days ago, around the 24th, the story broke on Russia Today. It's now fully confirmed that the Russian Navy suddenly decided to release, and this is so clearly a carefully selected maneuver, the Russian Navy decided to release a substantial number of files regarding UFO encounters on the part of the Russian Navy, most of which are underwater. Not necessarily underwater, but stuff seeing leaving the water, exiting the water. Now, we know those kind of reports have come in. Obviously, the Navy would be a good place to encounter that. I'm sure our Navy has, but it hasn't released any files. The Russian Navy just did. And so, essentially, this is Vladimir Putin and Medvedev, particularly Putin, who wants to be the symbol of a robust, reemerging, strong Russia. That's why he's constantly being photographed with all his muscles and his shirt off, you know, riding horses and fishing and doing the butterfly. Russia just sent a message to the U.S. Perhaps you should be the one to do this, but you keep putting it off. If you don't disclose, we'll do it, and we'll take that political legacy. Russia would like to be viewed as a major world power and leader again, after suffering the utter humiliation of having its empire disassembled into 14 republics, and its population reduced from about 300 and some million in the Soviet era to about 120 million now. That's very significant. This is just a taste of what has been happening in the last 8 years, which indicates that disclosure is coming up on us very, very fast. from one direction. It's going to happen someplace, if not the U.S.
Well, let me even bring up the fact, too, that it's the Russian Academy of Sciences who have been releasing UFO data for years, since the fall of the Soviet Union. And one of them, which I thought had some particular significance, was their Mars probe back about 15 years ago that they launched. And it went into orbit, the Phobos probe, and it took a picture of what seemed to be the shadow of a large craft. And then all of a sudden the probe ceased operations, or so they claim. Another example, like you brought up the fact that the Navy, I know a friend of mine who was a Navy diver. I'm not going to mention his name, but he was a Navy diver on board, I think it was the Forrestal, the aircraft carrier.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they witnessed a USO slash
the famous incident, yes.
Fly up, and he was one of the witnesses, and he saw that craft leave the ocean and fly up. Now, he told me about it, but he goes, we were told not to tell anybody anything, and they were threatened. And I also know a guy who went to a church that I used to attend in San Antonio, Texas, currently an Air Force staff sergeant training security personnel at Lackland Air Force Base. He worked out at Area 51 doing security. And I asked him if he'd ever seen aliens or UFOs at church one day. And he goes, well, let me put it this way. I believe that God created more than us. And I know that to be true. And that's what he told me. He would not tell me specifically what it was that he had seen out at Area 51. But he said he did believe in UFOs and aliens.
Well, these are examples of witnesses, what we call witnesses. And in this case, witness has kind of a specialized meaning. In the extraterrestrial UFO ET advocacy disclosure movement, witness refers, it's intended to refer to people who have worked in government. Right? There's been countless witnesses, millions of witnesses around the world that have seen something, right? Sightings and events and what have you. But in the advocacy arena, it refers to people who've been in government or in civilian capacity or in military, intelligence, even politicians, whatever. But they've kind of in places of authority, like the church, for instance, the Vatican, who have come forward and made statements about things they know or have seen or did or what have you. And that's important because people naturally feel that people who have worked in government, who have had positions of authority and what have you, have sort of a built-in gravitas. So these witnesses carry more weight than just a person just a regular person who sees something and reports it to the newspaper. I mean, this is a several levels up in terms of what we'll call substance from the standpoint of testimony. So you're referring to a couple. There have been many. And it's worth noting that throughout, and these witnesses have come forward, have turned up from time to time, going all the way back to the 50s. I mean, it's not like they just suddenly turned up. But after the Cold War ended, their numbers increased rapidly. And how far they were willing to go, how much they were willing to say, increased. Because the Cold War was a major barrier to people talking or taking risks with respect to what they knew. But the Cold War ended, and people felt emboldened. Now, it's notable that during this period, going back even to the 60s, 70s, 80s, there were members of the Russian government, military, even astronauts, particularly in the 80s, who would come forward and say things. But because of the Cold War mentality and all of the, the sensibility, of course, is they're the enemy, and they lie and misinform, and you can't trust them. You can't trust the Russians. You can't trust the Soviets. So these witnesses were just discounted out of hand. But I think the Russian witnesses that came forward from the military, from the astronaut corps, and what have you, that have spoken on the subject, are just as credible as the ones in the United States, frankly. Russia has, the Soviet Union and then Russia has played a significant role in the unfolding of this phenomena, but clearly the state, the Russian government, is not prepared yet to take a formal position, and the Soviet government definitely did take a formal position. But I don't think that necessarily is going to stay the same. I think Russia is definitely a candidate to end the ET truth embargo, as is China. And one of the reasons is that in during the Cold War, these were highly... This was a very interesting time. You had these highly controlled ideological states, and we were in a quasi-war posture with them. And so, not surprisingly, these governments had no desire whatsoever to toss the new information, the new reality of an ET presence engaging the human race into the mix to possibly undermine their ideological control, right? So they were not going to break ranks. But now it's 18 years since the Cold War ended, and China is a much different country, and Russia is obviously dramatically different than the Soviet Union. And so while they are still far more of a controlled state than we are, and I think more ideologically driven, China more so than Russia, I the idea that they wouldn't step forward and take this incredible historical legacy and be the first nation to break ranks and announce this truth is, I think, very reasonable possibility. And so they are on the list of nations that could end this embargo, along with France, the United Kingdom, Canada. And so the Obama administration simply has to understand. I know they got a lot in their plate right now, and it all seems important to them. But if they don't move it, if they don't get on the ball and start paying attention, and don't move to end this truth embargo, they're going to lose this legacy. And it's going to go to another nation, and we are going to have egg on our face, and we're going to have all of the downside, all of the public relations problems of the country that started this embargo and kept it going. We'll have to deal, but with none of the upside of being the country that finally revealed the truth. So it's going to be all downside, no upside for the United States. This is a huge issue in that sense. And those in the administration who think, don't worry, these other countries will just, they'll follow suit. Everybody, everybody jumps. When we say jump, everybody says how high. That isn't true anymore. It hasn't been true for a while. And so they're fooling themselves if they think they can just play with this and put it aside, and it'll all work out for them. It's not going to be that way. They need to act. They need to act very soon.
Well, and one other thing I wanted to bring up as well. We talked about it right before the show aired tonight, or began to air, and you were talking about like movies like District 9, E.T. and all. Mm. Are they preparing us for the eventual disclosure of the UFO E.T. Situation?
It may be an aspect to the entertainment genre that is acclimatization. But I don't think it's total. Recently, an absolutely superb article, it was like a paper, was written by two gentlemen by the name of Robbie Graham and Matthew Alford. They're out of Australia, and it's called The Deep Politics of Hollywood, Close Encounters with the Pentagon. Just Google that, Deep Politics of Hollywood, you'll find it. Superb article. I'd love to have one of them come to my next conference. They talk about this. There's no question that the issue is compelling, and so Hollywood embraced it. That's a given. There's no question that extraterrestrials sell at the box office and on television. No question about that. And thanks to Hollywood and television, the idea of extraterrestrials is virtually universal. There's just, with the exception of the most remotest people in the world living in third world conditions, everybody on this planet knows the concept of extraterrestrial, whether or not they believe they're here or not. And Hollywood has played a major role. And there's indications that the government, particularly in the early days of the truth embargo, tried to use, and maybe successfully did use, Hollywood to work the issue a little bit, depending on which way they wanted to go. But it's dangerous, because every time they interface with anybody on that subject, they are exposing themselves. and could blow up in their face. So I think they did some of it, but I don't think it's been extensive. I don't think you had to encourage Hollywood to sell put another Alien or E.T. movie out there. And if you look at the genre, there's, you know, a certain percentage of the films are good E.T., certain percentage of the films are bad E.T. Some of them are kind of neutral. Not surprisingly, there's been more bad E.T. movies than good E.T. movies because, you know, danger and evil and blowing stuff up sells. But it hasn't been exclusive. So I think the entertainment world was playing a typical role here with this, as they do with other issues, whether it's the environment or nuclear power or abuses of power, the national security state, things like that. They have had movies going both ways, and if there's a public interest in it, they're gonna produce. So I wouldn't overplay that. I think what is more significant is that Hollywood has made a fortune, an absolute fortune on the subject matter. Hollywood and television industry, the entertainment industry, and just billions upon billions of dollars in revenues. And with no exception that I am aware of, has not contributed a penny to the citizens' efforts to get to the truth. And that, to me, is very discouraging and saddening in a way. Now, maybe there have been some monies that have been contributed privately, and we just don't know about it. But if anything at all. And this is not good. And I'm wondering if they have been threatened from time to time. Look, make your movies, but don't take any of those profits and start funding the advocacy work. Don't start taking ads in the paper saying, you know, this E.T. thing is real. That could have happened. It's easy to threaten somebody. All it takes is one phone call. And be persuasive. And if they think you're the real deal, and they got a lot to lose, then they'll probably go along with it. But we don't know. We may never know. So there's some really intense E.T. movies coming out, and they're pretty negative and violent, in my understanding. In fact, I intend to see them all. But, you know, the American people are very sophisticated on this issue now, by and large, particularly the kids. They understand the difference. They know what's going on. The Internet provides a huge amount of information. So somebody's not going to go see a bad E.T. movie and assume automatically that E.T.'s are bad. Though it does affect people. I mean, it's part of your psyche. There's no question. But I'm not too down on Hollywood. I think Hollywood is done probably more good than bad in terms of moving us toward resolution on this issue. But I am very discouraged that they haven't seen the wisdom of returning some of the money that has come to him. Because a lot of the money they have made is because of the awareness, and a lot of that awareness of this issue was done by researchers who slaved for decades to try to understand and put out the information about this issue in books and documentaries and what have you, virtually making nothing from it, usually out of their own pocket. And Hollywood has basically ridden on their backs without really giving anything back. So I would like to see that change.
Well, and I agree totally with you on that. And another thing I wanted to bring up is the mere fact, since we're talking about how Hollywood and the entertainment industry as a whole is using the UFO and ET scenarios to their advantage. We could go back in history, especially back to 1939 with the War of the Worlds broadcast, in which Orson Welles played it off as an actual news broadcast and scared the bejesus out of everyone.
Right.
Now, if you look at it from that perspective, what a lot of people do not know is at the time, and recently, within the last 15 years, the information became public that Orson Welles got his money to do that particular episode from the Rockefeller Foundation. And they were doing a psychological warfare experiment to see what would happen if they brought up invasion of the world scenario, and they found out that it would scare the you-know-what out of people.
Well, I am aware of this, and I think there's been a lot of overreaction to that event. First of all, if in fact it was an experiment that Orson Welles went along with, leading into, you know, there was a war brewing, and everybody knew it, and the radio was becoming increasingly powerful, and I think people wondered what influence it would have, and how do people react to these things. I don't think the subject matter was critical. It could have created any number of broadcasts that could have scared people badly, but they chose that one. So I don't think it was an attempt to experiment with the ET issue, but rather with the power of to find out how people react to some sort of crisis like that, and also how they react to it being presented to them on the radio. So I don't see too much sinister aspects to it in that regard. Now, ironically, this event was used, has been referred to often as a reason why people cannot handle the truth about ETs down the line, which is ironic for this reason. That event was essentially a situation where an authority institution, an institution of authority, in this case a substantial radio network, deliberately put out false information, right, in a way that was intended to for you to believe is true. And it was scary information, and it upset people, and they reacted, not surprisingly. I mean, look, if ABC News tomorrow were to fake a sudden news flash and come on and say they just learned that a major meteor 2 miles wide was just discovered, and it's only, 150,000 miles out, and it's going to hit in about 15 hours, there would be mass panic. And what would that prove? It would prove that when institutions of authority lie to the people, they can scare them. The issue of the ET embargo is just the opposite, right? The government needs to tell us the truth about what's going on. And the failure to tell the truth has opened the door for all manner of speculation and theories, and some of which are quite scary. So, in fact, the event of 1939 and the October, the broadcast on Halloween night, is a lesson in truth-telling, not in lying. But it's been used as an excuse. Oh, no, you see, people will panic if you tell them terrible things and so forth. So there's a lot of ironies there. That was a long time ago, Paul. It was, 60 years, right? The anniversary of that is coming up in just about 20 weeks, and I'll bet that there'll be a lot done about that. You're going to see a lot of stuff in the media on the 60th anniversary of that event, and there will be those that will seize on it as another reason to justify extending the truth embargo and what have you. But we are a lot more sophisticated today, I can assure you, than the people listening to that broadcast in 1939. And there's a reason why open transparency is a big part of the Democratic platform right now, whether they're serving it appropriately or not. The future is open transparency. Secrecy is a toxic poison, and it's caused terrible damage over the centuries. The leaders know this, and they know they have to move towards open transparency, or things are just going to get worse and worse. So we're heading in that direction. The question is, can we get there fast enough before some sex series or a single event suddenly derails the human race, and we take some radical right turn off into darkness? Which is there. I mean, the possibility is there. It can happen at any time. So this is why the truth embargo needs to end sooner. It needs to end immediately. We cannot afford to allow this to go on. We need this information, and we need to be able to respond to it. And then what will be. But when you play around with reality at this level, when you misrepresent reality at this level, there's all manner of bad things that can happen. And we got enough bad things going on in the world, so we need to get in the truth business. And this is the best start that I can imagine. And will have dramatic impact on trust in government and a lot of other things.
Well, one thing that I wanted to bring up, though, to add on to what I was saying, is that the Rockefeller Foundation, even in the 1990s, supported a private report on the UFO and ET situation that was given to the UN. And the point I'm making about that, it's the same foundation who, and it wasn't 60 but 70 years ago in 1939, financed the War of the Worlds broadcast.
Okay.
What I'm concerned about is the mere fact that we still have a lot of naive people out there who are not, how should I put it, not to put people down, but they're ignorant and not educated enough to to really know the difference between what may be real and what may not be real. And if you remember back in the 1980s, when then President Ronald Reagan made statements in front of the UN, school children, so on and so forth, about the mere fact that what would happen if we were brought into a situation where we were being attacked from people outside of our planet, how could that unify us? And what I'm thinking they may try to do, the global elite, is that they may try to use the ET scenario to bring about a causal situation to bring forth a new world order.
Well, another war, perhaps, or at least or manipulate the public. Well, the fact is that this technique has been used in the past. There's no question. It's also the case that we're in a different world now, and particularly because of the Internet, this issue has been raised all over the world countless times on countless programs and discussed at length. So it's not like we're not aware of this possibility. Do I think it will happen? I do not think so, but it could happen. But to the larger point, you raised one of the most important points, I think, in the world today in terms of whether or not we're going to have a good century or a really awful century. And that is one of the most fundamental skill that any person, every person must develop if they want their life to be, to go well, is being able to discern what is real and what is not real. And this is a skill you learn by practicing it, right? It doesn't come downloaded to you at birth. That's why we educate ourselves. That's why we go to school. That's why we learn. That's why our parents teach us how to tell the real from the unreal. And it's an imperfect skill, but the better you are at it, the better your life will go. And the more you exercise it, the better you get at it. So when the government in any way interferes with that process, it diminishes the capacity of people to, quote, develop that skill. And as everyone knows, everyone under the age of, 60, too, has lived their entire life during a period of intense propaganda in the world, primarily most of it occurring during the Cold War from after the war till 91, huge propaganda being generated on both sides and a lot of other places in the world trying to, quote, misrepresent reality in order to serve ideological and political purposes. And so we swam through a sea of propaganda for decade after decade, and at the same time, the ET reality was being misrepresented to us, in spite of the evidence that was all around us. And so our generation, the baby boom generation, my generation rather, has been subjected to an enormous amount of government manipulation of reality, and so it has really hurt our ability to tell the difference sometimes. It's made us more susceptible. And we've passed some of that on to Generation X. Well, what can I say? We got to get out of that. We got to get away from that. We have to get the government out of the business of screwing around with the representation of reality. If the government wants to institute a directive saying that the moon is made of green cheese, it can do that, and it could spend a lot of money convincing us it's made of green cheese. But it's a waste of money, and it's damaging and destructive, and they shouldn't do that. Right?
Stephen, we only have 1 minute left, or less than 1 minute left
in the
show. And it's been great talking to you. Could you quickly give them your website information?
Well, ParadigmResearchGroup.org is the main one, but I want them to know factsonwashington.org. That's facts, F-A-X, on Washington.org. It's fully underway. Right now, all the letters and correspondence is going into the White House Press Corps, care of the White House Correspondents Association. All the information is that website. We need people to send letters, faxes, and emails, demanding that the White House Corps and the other political press in Washington start asking the questions that must be asked about this issue and demanding appropriate answers. Thousands have already been sent. Robert Gibbs got bumped about it on C-SPAN the other day. There's going to be more of that. But every single letter, fax, and email makes a difference now. We must get these in. So factsonwashington.org, it's the most important ongoing project of Paradigm Research Group. We need people to step up and write those letters, faxes, and emails, the info and questions you can refer to, and the support for those questions, the links, all at factsonwashington.org. You can read it. It's not that hard. Take 10 minutes. But we've got to have those letters going in. We've got to let the press know we're ready for them to do their job on this issue, finally, after 60 years.
Okay, and thank you again, Stephen, for being on my show.
You're welcome.
Great having you. And I would like to thank all my listeners for listening. And you will find the truth here. What you do with it is up to you. This is Paul Richard Price signing off tonight. And I'd like to thank Joe Montaldo and the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. Signing off, good night, and God bless.
That's International Community Radio.